Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pop Almanac, episode 13.
Presented by Culture Map Austin, I'm Brendan K. O'Grady.
I'm Duncan Carson. Brendan, how you doing, man?
I'm feeling the spirit.
Yeah? What kind of spirit?
I'm feeling the holiday spirit, Duncan.
Why? Why is that?
Well, we are recording this one not in our usual location at the Culture Map Austin World Headquarters and Forward Launch Command. Instead, we are in my living room.
We're in Brendan's living room.
Here in fabulous central Austin, Texas, and we're looking at my pretty tree.
Are we in central Austin? Is that...
Yeah, this is we're in the heart of Austin, Texas.
I still don't know neighborhoods.
Oh, well, okay. First of all, you live less than a mile from my house. You should probably know what neighborhood you live in.
Just, you know, it seems north to me because I always go south to get to places.
Right. Well, because we were happening men about downtown.
Yes, yes. So men about town.
Yeah. So we're always heading downtown to where the, quote, action is.
I'm always going down to 6th Street to maintain my appearance as a billionaire playboy.
Right.
In my secret identity, but anyway,
you wear a double-breasted white tuxedo like no one I've seen.
Well, it's real disheveled. I mean, people are just like, he's always drunk. He could never be a costume crime fighter. But it is the Christmas season. You've got a very nice tree with a tree skirt.
You couldn't be Batman. I get it. I got it. Sorry, it took me a second on that one. Yeah, no, we're sitting here recording this podcast by the light. By the light of my lovely fake tree, and it's a nice tree. It's like 5.5 feet tall, something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty festive in here. There's wreaths.
Yeah, completely not my doing. completely my wonderful girlfriend's doing.
None of his touch at all.
Well, but this is the first year we've decorated my house since, like, you know, I haven't. I've lived away from home. I haven't been around my folks. My mom used to do up the house huge, you know.
Sure.
My first time decorating since I've not lived with my parents, and I gotta say, it feels great. It feels really, really nice.
Does it? Like having your own tree?
Yeah. Like just enjoying the feeling of the spirit. We have a fake tree, and we have a pine scented, like really natural smell. And that sounds like the most cliche tacky thing in the world. But it smells like a fresh pine tree in this household right now.
Pine scented fake tree. It does smell nice.
It's really, really nice. And so all through December, like really right after Thanksgiving, when we put the stuff up, like for the entire like 6 weeks or whatever. Before the actual holiday happens, I'd come home and I would watch Netflix with no light but the beautiful Christmas tree. Aww. In my house. It's very, very nice. It gets you into it.
That's the season. I don't know.
I guess what I learned is that I didn't even know it, but I'm just a sucker for the holiday season. I'm a sucker for I like it. Are you a holidays guy?
Generally, yeah. I mean, I feel like it's kind of foregone. Like, I'm not religious in any regard at all. So that aspect of it is not, you know, my personal business. I get that it's other people's. I don't care about the war on Christmas. Just going to put that out there. Just say happy holidays, people. I don't want to get controversial. But I love gathering with my friends and exchanging presents with people. Is that really up for debate? Like, I love the holidays. I don't get overly sentimental or anything.
I am not a big gift giver.
Really?
Well, the thing is, like, I would almost rather, well, I would definitely rather not receive presents.
Yeah.
If it meant I don't have to buy for people. Because well, the thing is, I agonize over it, and it drives me nuts when I can't think of, I want to be the guy who gets people perfect presents and, like, really, really, like, kind of shows them, like, that I understand, I'm invested in this friendship, like, I have insight, I know something to get you to be just perfect. Uh-huh. I want to be that guy, but I always wind up getting into something where it's like, oh, well, I have one of these and it's useful, so maybe you'd like it. Like, that's inevitably.
There's a band you might like, man. I don't. Or you end up getting them a gift card and you feel like a jerk.
I won't do it. I won't do the gift card. That is a line I won't cross.
You'll just not get them a present.
Right. Right. I would sooner spit in your face than give you this gift card.
Oh, that's terrible.
$20 to Best Buy. Ugh.
I don't know. I'm in kind of a weird spot because, like, my mother's family gets really great presents. Traditionally, they always have. She's mm-hmm. got 5 siblings. And they all get great gifts. All right? And now they just keep giving me presents. I'm not a kid anymore. So now I feel like I have to reciprocate and get them presents in return because I'm an adult, in quotes. And that's a little bit of a question this year. You know, I can't really break the bank on Christmas.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know,
I don't have decorations or like a tree at my place or like much furniture.
You're doing well, either. But it costs you a lot more to clean that double-breasted white tuxedo than people might realize.
It's I'm actually just really dedicated to the appearance of being an average human being that's not a superhero at all. I've taken it that far. I haven't even fought crime in a decade. That's how committed I am to my secret identity. All right, so that's Christmas. We just kind of enjoy it. We don't really have any huge Christmas opinions, right?
No, we talked about the possibility of doing an episode similar to the one that we did for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized, wait, didn't Thanksgiving come up? And we said, we talked about maybe doing Thanksgiving, but screw it. I definitely think that the holiday special thing has been a little bit played out. But I inevitably can't help but think about the fact that I watch Charlie Brown Christmas, like, every single year.
Okay.
We talked about It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, back in Halloween times. Back in Halloween times? Way back.
Halloween times.
Way back in the HT era.
Classic days.
We talked about that. A Charlie Brown Christmas is, in many ways, a cult movie, I realize. I belong to this little cult of Christmas, where I have this ritualization around watching this movie. And, I mean, okay, maybe it's not fair to call that specifically a cult movie.
It's pretty well known, but I feel like it's such a cultural shorthand at this point.
Yeah.
That it qualifies, you know, like...
Yeah.
Like, that's probably the most enjoyment I've ever heard hearing scripture. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
When Linus, you know, comes on center stage and explains what Christmas means.
Right.
It's a beautiful moment, and I make a reference to the tree basically all the time.
Well, I feel like at this point,
just needs a little love.
It's ubiquitous,
right?
In terms of people are aware of it, but it's not necessarily something that everyone accesses. Like everyone knows it's on every year, and most people have seen it in their lifetime.
Yeah.
But I don't know that everyone sits down to watch it once a year. I don't sit down to watch it when it airs on TV. I just go, well, it's December. I have to watch this movie.
Right. Yeah, you have to put it on. It's a ritual.
Right, which I feel like is part of what typifies the cult experience. And that got us thinking about a subject that we haven't talked about yet on the show.
Cult
phenomena. Cult pop cultural phenomena.
Like, when do you start calling something a cult? It's always a pretty gray area. Especially when you're defining real cults. But that's not why we're here.
Yeah, we're not here to cast judgment.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about Scientology or anything like that.
My only religion is not buying people gift cards.
We're talking about pop culture cults. Let's make that clear from the start.
And typically when we talk about pop cultural cults, the thing we talk about is cult movies.
Of course.
Right? Cult movies seem to have like this really clear identity. People talk about this being as like, oh, it's a cult film. It's a cult flick.
Right.
But
a cult classic.
That a cult classic. Movie, yeah. But what defines a cult film? What defines a cult phenomenon?
So, once again, we need to define criteria for what makes a cult movie, which is not something I had ever bothered to do, because that's not how my brain works. But we decided it's something that needs to, like, sort of initially not catch on, right?
Yeah. When we mentioned the idea of instant classics, we flirted with the idea of something being an instant cult classic.
Right.
But really, it kind of requires there being that initial flop or that initial like lack of instant relevance.
Right. Or some sort of controversy that makes it not a mainstream hit.
Right.
You know, like certain horror movies or whatever. And then also, of course, you know, the cult persistence, like a real positive word of mouth. A small but supportive group of fans that keep it alive.
Mm-hmm.
Well beyond its initial, you know, release cycle or the life of a typical movie.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, the basic definition of it would be something that has a very devoted fan base.
Very.
That is also a very limited fan base for some specific reason. Meaning... You cannot have a mainstream cult movie. You can have cults that are well known to the mainstream,
right?
Right, but you can't have people who are really hardcore actual members of the cult be something that is the norm. For me, the movie that I think about when I think of like the term the cult classic and what it's supposed to define, what's supposed to typify, is the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Of course, the longest running movie in America.
Yeah, because it's constantly on. Like, but that's a technicality. But like, but you can go to theaters right now in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. There's Alamo Drafthouse plays the Rocky Horror Picture Show every single Saturday night.
Really, every week?
Every week. This is a movie that probably most people who are casual film fans have or will see in their lifetime, right? People are familiar with it. They're aware of it.
Yeah, everybody knows somebody that's like, you know, goes to it regularly or performs in the little pantomime they do.
But most people aren't of that group. Like, most people who know that, like, they might know Let's Do the Time Warp Again or something, sure. Right? Like, they might know that Tim Curry is in it or something. But there are the people who comprise what made an actual cult, right, that shows a devotion, where they dress up, where they go out, they participate in the theater aspect of it, right? Those are the cultists, right? And they are a relatively small number of people. I mean, it's actually one of the larger cult movies there is, because it's been running forever. But
yeah, it's probably one of the biggest.
Right. But it's a passionate fan base that is also still necessarily a limited one. It is not, by definition, a huge mainstream thing to be a person who goes out every Saturday night dressed as...
Are there really people that go every week? I find that hard to believe.
I mean, probably not every single week, but I mean, there are definitely those people who go... Who you know, there's 52 Saturdays in a year,
yeah,
and sure. They make it out to Rocky Horror for 30 of them.
30 of them. They say all the lines and throw toast and shit like that.
Yeah.
And in Milwaukee's Oriental Theater, they had it once a month,
mm-hmm.
which seemed more reasonable to me. I'm like, that would be a fun monthly event. Like, you could dress up with your friends and, you know, make fun of people on stage or whatever you do.
I couldn't imagine getting through it once. I've seen Rocky Horror, and it's a shitty movie.
Have you gone, like, to it as, like, an event?
I have gone to it as an event, as a spectator,
mm-hmm.
because I saw the movie for the first time on television around Halloween one year,
oh.
and I thought it was terrible because I was just sitting there watching it alone.
You may as well watch the really crappy Glee episode about it.
I might have watched that really crappy Glee episode, and I might have hated it. You thought I was going to turn around on that one. No, it was terrible. No,
it was terrible.
But because I had seen it and because I knew it was this huge thing, I'm like, oh, well, maybe the experience of seeing it live. I look around and I go, wow, these people are really into this mm-hmm. terrible, terrible movie. Like, but that's the thing. They've devoted themselves to this cultural, this side aspect of it, right? That has relatively little to do with the movie itself. Right. And now it's the communal aspect of seeing the movie that has become the phenomenon.
Right. I mean, I think it's definitely something that started, because we're really kind of talking about two different things here. When, like, a movie has a cult of devoted fans, that certainly happens a lot for movies that fail or whatever. I think Scott Pilgrim was the initial example we were toying with in our first episode. But then there's when a movie becomes a cult phenomenon like Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that takes on a life of its own, that's obviously more enthusiasm than the film itself ever generated in the first place.
Right.
Because, you know, it's campy on purpose and, like, fun and weird, and it's got, I don't know, progressive sexual themes or something, but yeah. It's not like it really had, you know, that big of an impact at the time. And the only real comparable cult movie to Rocky Horror these days, or at least that I've noticed, is the people that get together and watch Tommy Wiseau's The Room. They screened that at midnight at the Oriental Theater more than once. Like, it was so popular, they brought it back 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And had two consecutive midnight showings, because people, like, really love showing up and shitting on a terrible, terrible film made by a deluded, you know, auteur.
And that poor guy, like, he seems to be, okay, he's now playing into the fact that The Room has an audience of any kind.
Right.
And I mean, now he's at this point pretty much making a living off of it. Like he goes around with the movie and stuff, and like, and he's kind of willing to make fun of himself, but he's also kind of playing it off like this was intentionally campy.
Right, I think he's tried to, like, backpedal it and be like, yeah, The Room, it's nuts, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's totally what I meant.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa! Right? Wink? Wink? Question mark?
Chewed so much scenery, you guys. That's what you say, right? Chewed scenery? I don't know. But he seems a little guileless, though. Like, he just wants to be popular.
Right.
And I feel bad. I can't bring myself to watch it or go...
No, yeah, it's so not for me, but it definitely typifies what you're talking about with Rocky Horror, where This thing was not made to be a cult classic. Right. Like, there's no way it could have been, right? Like, you can tell, obviously, Wiseau is kind of acting like it's not, but nobody really feels that way about that movie. The reason that people respond to it really well is that the movie itself is guileless, right? Like, it's not ironic. It's not detached.
Right.
There's nothing even close to holding the audience at arm's length from this horrible thing, this horrible piece of shit that is unfolding.
This awful, awful thing.
And another movie that reminded me of The Room, a movie that I've actually have seen, is Birdemic.
Birdemic. I hear that's crazy bad.
No, it's just awful. And it instantly sprung up this cult of, oh my god, this thing is so bad, you have to see it.
Is it?
Yeah, it's terrible.
But I have to see it? That's my question.
No, not at all. No, not at all. And that's one of the big recurring subplots. We don't have to talk about all these movies in great depth, right?
Right.
Because we're talking about what makes for a cult. And one of the big subplots that I find with these things is that mostly it seems like an excuse for people to get enjoyment out of something that they know is bad that they don't, but they seem to like anyway.
Yeah, I don't really get that, to be honest. Like, I understand, like, I'm a big Mystery Science Theater 3000 guy. Like, mm-hmm. that's fun because it was on TV and not very serious. And, you know, those guys write funny jokes. And I like doing that with my friends sometimes with bad movies. But making it a whole event like that, making it how they gain a life of their own is beyond me.
Well, there are cases of it that I understand and that I respect or even like, mm-hmm. In terms of the phenomena of how the cult forms. When you think of like the older movies, like, you know, Freaks or Plan 9 from Outer Space,
right.
People have this almost reverence for the spirit in which they were made. It's not mocking, it is accessing a time where right. you thought, wow, can you imagine making this movie in the 30s? Like,
right, yeah.
You know, how crazy, like, how, like, just balls out tough do you have to be to say, this is my vision and I'll make it happen, right? Like, a guy like Ed Wood became right. this, he, okay, sure, campy, but became this respected after the fact dreamer.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's almost like Willy Wonka, if Willy Wonka just had a shitty rundown factory, like, just made crap-tasting candy, but just really wanted to make the world happy.
Tricked a church into making a terrible sci-fi movie.
Right.
Then he would be Willy Wonka. But Ed Wood is a great film because of that nostalgia for it.
Yeah, well, for a lot of Ed Wood's a great movie for a lot of reasons. Right. But like, Planet from Outer Space is not a good movie, but it is a movie where I can understand people coming together around the idea of watching this movie, not just because it's bad, and partially because it's bad and that's entertaining in and of itself, in a kind of jaded, detached way, but also because there's something special about the kind of almost handcrafted nature of its badness, you know?
Exactly.
And how people like the person, like the idea of the person behind it making it.
Right, and I think there's, like, that sort of enthusiasm is rare these days. Like, that's what it were, because, like, a film like Sam Raimi's Evil Dead, which is a goofy horror movie that's, like, you know, made on a shoestring budget by a bunch of friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's you know, solidly made as a horror movie in its way. But I think people love that and watch it on Halloween because it's made with genuine emotion and goofy and fun.
Well, and they were teenagers when they made that movie,
exactly.
Right? They were all, like, 20 years old.
Yeah, they were barely in film school or whatever. And, you know, a lot of love went into it. Now we just shit on terrible things and laugh to ourselves.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm trying to say here. Maybe it is the Christmas spirit. But come on, guys. Just have some enthusiasm.
Well, and Evil Dead's a good example because I had that written on my list. And Evil Dead is a movie that when I saw it, I was like, oh, this isn't very good. And then I later kind of got like, oh, that is the charm of it and that's why people like it.
Right.
But there's another movie that was made by Sam Raimi, Army of Darkness. I'm not talking about Evil Dead 2, which is basically just a remake of Evil Dead.
Basically the same.
Army of Darkness is the first time anyone's, like, really given him money to make a movie with. And mm-hmm. and he of course, had a very ambitious vision of what to do with what is in reality not a huge budget.
Sure.
But I had friends who talked about Army of Darkness as like their favorite movie, and how great it was, right? Like, and I'm not just talking about people who talked about Evil Dead as being this cult movie that's fun to watch, but like, just, I didn't realize that there was a cult around Army of Darkness. I had it packaged to me as like, yeah, Evil Dead's kind of a cult movie. Army of Darkness is really good though.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I watched it, and I think it's just, It's not good.
There's a certain Admiral, like, bananas craziness to it. Like, doesn't he, like, see little versions of himself and all this crazy stuff happens?
Yeah.
It's like Gremlins 2 as compared to Gremlins. Like, it's just stepped up in every sort of direction.
Right, and there are people I know who will advocate for Gremlins 2 as this, oh my god, it's so crazy and over the top. And I feel like that's that point at which the scales tip from genuine admiration, you know, right. Like being kind of like the good way, the honest way to come by having a cult following, versus that jaded, cynical way of having a following.
Like trying too hard is just not the way to do it.
Well, it's not even just trying too hard, but it is openly courting that response that other movies that other examples garner because of something that comes from positivity or like, I guess, sweetness, for lack of a better term, right? Like that, you know, that Ed Wood exhibited the earnestness behind it, right? Earnestness is the right word. But instead you can make a movie like Snakes on a Plane, which was tailor made as soon as they saw, oh, the internet seems to like this terrible idea for a terrible movie because based on its terrible name.
Now we're trying to
we'll give them Snakes on a Plane.
Now we're trying to play into that. I bet Tommy Wiseau wants to make The Room 2 and capitalize on his bad.
I think he does want to make The Room 2, in fact. I think he is making The Room 2.
Well, that'll probably be as terrible as Snakes on a Plane, because you can't do it on purpose. That.
No, you can't make it happen on purpose. Like, so these made-to-order, the idea of a made-to-order cult phenomenon, right? Like, Snakes on a Plane is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple examples of that written down here. I feel like I didn't see it, because why would I possibly see it? But there's a movie that came out, I believe this year, called A Serbian Film.
A Serbian Film?
Are you familiar with this?
No.
It is a film made in Serbia, and it is supposed to be basically just the ultimate in complete shock value filmmaking. Like there's like, I believe there's a scene where somebody uses a baby as a silencer for a gun.
Jesus.
Yeah, like, and it's just this like, it's just an unending parade of over the top, like this is stuff from Uwe Boll's Nightmares. Like, it's just this string of over the top stuff, and the only reason it seems like a movie like that would exist is to just have as much visceral impact as possible. And every person I know, or every review I've seen, everyone I know who's seen a Serbian film, everyone's kind of responds the same way, which is that stuff is so numbing after such a very short time,
right,
that the movie actually winds up having very little impact, and you just sit there thinking, oh, this person made this movie for it to be remembered.
For this.
Yeah, just for any reason whatsoever.
Well, whoever made that should, like, have they not heard of YouTube? That's what YouTube's for.
You know? Right, yeah. You pretend that stuff's real on the internet, anonymously, and then it lives forever.
You get view counts, and you don't make somebody sit through 2 hours of it. Good lord.
Well, okay, so maybe a Serbian film was a little too obscure, but there's a movie, sequel to a movie that came out this year, called The Human Centipede Full Sequence. Which sequel to The Human Centipede.
The Human Centipede, of course. Which is, I guess, a cult thing? I mean, like, the amount of coverage I saw it get when it premiered here at Fantastic Fest. Everyone was like, Human Centipede 2, guys! I'm like,
really? It premiered at Fantastic Fest.
Right.
It
was like opening night. Was it not?
Well, right, but you're talking about Fantastic Fest as though that's a large event.
Oh, well, that's a good point.
What is Fantastic Fest for those who don't know?
It's like a 7-day... B-movie festival run by the Alamo Drafthouse? Like,
not a B-movie festival.
Okay.
It's a genre film festival.
Genre film festival. My bad. The world's largest genre film festival.
Right, which means they show upwards of 20 movies. No, it has grown a lot, and it is run by Tim and Terry Lee behind the Alamo Drafthouse.
Right.
And they've done a lot of, like, interesting stuff in terms of encouraging submissions from other countries and just trying to get as many movies screened as possible that would never really get a chance to be screened.
Right.
But that's not a large audience that ever accesses these movies in the first place.
Well, it seems tailored, like, to what you're speaking to, like ready-made cult movies. That's specifically why he made another Human Centipede. To get into things like that and to get notoriety for being ridiculous.
Right, yeah, that's true.
Because, like, Human Centipede, it's like, I love the reviews, almost, because the best quotes, my favorite one is like, almost more disgusting to read about than to watch. Which is probably true, in practice, because you know it's not real, but it's a disgusting idea.
Have you seen either of the movies?
No.
Really? Human Centipede's on Netflix.
Why is that surprising?
No curiosity whatsoever?
Kind of. I think I might have read some spoilers. I'm like, does the human centipede get away? I don't... Probably not. I think they die. I'm sorry. But why would I want to watch that? That sounds terrible. I'm not a big horror guy to begin with.
Well, honestly, I think the human centipede has about as much value as, say, Saw in terms of...
Yeah.
Like, with the first time you watch the first Saw movie... You can at least go along with some aspect of suspense that exists in it before it just descends into outright murder torture porn.
Right.
Like, there is an element of acceptable, you know, horror suspense filmmaking that goes into that movie. And then, of course, that movie becomes... I feel like Saw itself is almost like this too mainstreamed version of what genre film fans, like real diehard cult horror movie fans, want to see. Like, I kind of feel like the popularity of torture porn,
yeah,
has become this sort of odd mirror of a version of cult phenomenon that is now being enjoyed by this disproportionately large audience.
I feel it is weird because it's almost like that industry hit on exactly what its fans want.
Right.
They're like, they want to see some pretty people get abducted and then mutilated and then one of them gets away. And every single movie is the same.
Yeah.
And they eat it up. Or like Saw, you know, there'll be some ridiculous contraptions and then nonsense serialized mythology that carries over to the next one. Like, I don't know how that dude kept terrorizing people after he died of cancer, but that's a whole other story. I haven't seen a single Saw movie. But I will paraphrase the plot of every single one.
We really need to start talking about some movies that we've seen. Like, I've seen two of the Saw movies.
Okay.
I've seen Human Centipede. I know what we're talking about. And the point is cogent.
I'm just not a horror guy. All right.
Okay. So what are some of the things that you want to talk about with understanding cult phenomena? All
right. The only other category of cult movies that I would want to mention is like a cult that springs up around one particular director or writer or filmmaker. Because the big example was David Lynch on, like, list of classic cult movies. Eraserhead is always high up there.
Yeah.
And basically every one of his films is something that, on a mainstream level, is completely impenetrable. Like Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, you know, even Twin Peaks doesn't make a lot of sense.
Which is probably his most mainstreamed thing he ever made. Right, right? Yeah. Twin Peaks was made for network television.
Right, and it got popular in its way.
Yeah.
But didn't last that long.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of hit in its moment based on that initial, you know, Who Killed Laura Palmer,
right,
like, hook. But then, I mean, the show trailed off and, you know, got two seasons and that's it.
Yeah, and it's something that took a while to become available on, like, VHS or DVD or whatever.
Right, and you know, word of its legend grew and grew.
And if it wasn't made by David Lynch, it might not ever have, you know, it would just fade into history. Nobody would care. Because people, you know, follow David Lynch around like a cult, I would say. And they're just ready to take whatever crazy symbolism he's got. Have you seen Inland Empire?
Nope.
It makes absolutely no sense. Like, a Mulholland Drive, you know, it's probably his most accessible movie. Even though it takes, you know,
and that is saying something.
But Mulholland Drive, it even just, like, takes a left turn halfway through and just becomes a different movie entirely, almost. But Inland Empire is just completely inaccessible, as much as I love Laura Dern and David Lynch. But, you know, that's the only other, like, cult point I would make.
Yeah, it does seem interesting that there are certain directors, certain writers, certain people behind the art,
right,
who almost seem to can't help themselves but only make these cult fare pieces. And I don't just mean because of the genre, but because of their innate sensibilities or something that will appeal very, very strongly to some people, but only to certain people, right? David Lynch is one,
yep,
in part because I think surrealism is never going to be for everybody, right? But when we talked about, we devoted an entire episode talking about Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson's practically got a cult sprung up around his movies.
Sure.
And he has a very specific aesthetic visual sense, and some people connect very, very strongly to it. But it's not like he's making, you know, $100 million blockbuster movies. His movies make money, but they aren't the kind of thing that is necessarily, like, my mother wouldn't be able to pick a Wes Anderson movie out of a lineup, right? But there are people who will latch on to very specific things about the way that he makes movies.
Definitely. And, you know, I'd say, like, Charlie Kaufman is another one of those guys for me.
His yeah, absolutely.
Screenwriter. I mean, he's had a little bit of success. Maybe 20, 30 million for some features, but that's... Right. You know, it's more of a thing where I'm like, everybody's excited about a certain person's next project, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
And those other guys we mentioned.
Well, let's not tip our hands too much, because we're going to talk about this a little bit more next week. Nobody wants to hear us blather on right before the holidays finish.
It's December 21st. You guys probably have Christmas shopping to finish, your own cult movies to buy.
Or some other kind of holiday-related activity that is less specifically denominational.
You want to buy all three of the Santa Clauses. Probably. There's a big cult around those. And we're going to come back next week and talk about...
We're going to talk about something related.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see you then. Until then, have a happy holiday.
You can like The Pop Almanac on Facebook.
You can follow it on Twitter at Pop Almanac.
I'm at BK O'Grady.
And I'm at A. Duncan Christ.
Y'all have happy holidays. We'll see you soon. What's on your mind when you're tired at the end?